The master of the house stands at the garden wall. It is a grim stretch of stone, an iron door locked and bolted at its center. There is a narrow gap between the door and the rock, and when the breeze is right, it carries the scent of summer, sweet as melon, and the distant warmth of sun. There is no breeze tonight, no moon, and yet he is bathed in moonlight. It catches the edges of his tattered coat. It shines on the bones where they show through his skin. He trails his hand along the wall, searching for cracks. Stubborn strands of ivy follow in his wake, questing like fingers into every fissure, and nearby a bit of stone breaks free and tumbles to the ground, exposing a narrow slice of someone else's night. The culprit, a field mouse, scrambles through and then down the wall over the master's boot. He catches it in one hand with all the grace of a snake. He bends his head to the crack, fastens his milk-white eyes on the other side. The other garden, the other house. In his hand, the mouse squirms, and the master squeezes. "Hush," he says in a voice like empty rooms. He is listening to the other side, to the soft chirp of bird song, the wind through lush leaves, the distant pleading of someone in their sleep. The master smiles and picks up the bit of broken rock and nestles it back into the wall, where it waits like a secret. The mouse has stopped squirming in the cage of his grip. When he opens his hand, there is nothing left but a streak of ash and rot and a few white teeth, little bigger than seeds. He tips them out onto the wasted soil and wonders what will grow. That's a quote from Gallant by V.E. Schwab. This is YA Book Chat, and I'm your host, Leah Stuhler. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of YA Book Chat. Thank you so much for being here and for listening. And as always, a special thank you to my Patreon members for your financial support. I really, really appreciate it. Today, I am bringing you yet another fantastic author interview. I am always so thrilled when I have the chance to do this. And you guys are really going to love this one. We are going to be talking about the brand new book, Gallant, by V.E. Schwab, and she is here herself with me today. You might know her as a number one New York Times and USA and indie best-selling author. She is the author of many adult and young adult and middle grade books, such as The Near Witch, the Archive series, the Monsters of Verity, and a Darker Shade of Magic series, as well as a more recent one, which you've probably heard of, The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. And so I would just like to say welcome. It is so great to have you here.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Of course. Let me first just say I read Addie when it first came out and I absolutely loved it. It's so fantastic and such a creative and unique work. I had never read anything like it before and I really loved it.
Oh, thank you so much. That was a 10-year in the making work. So I'm very grateful when people like it.
How many books have you published now? What number is Gallant?
21.
21. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Does it ever get old or is it always like just as exciting with each book?
It's just as exciting. I mean, there are certain steps that are just as exciting, like getting the cover and getting to hold the finished copy. I would say that like it doesn't get easier or harder. It just like your brain expands to fill the space. So each time you're trying to like do better than the last, but it's all subjective and better is not a helpful word. And so you try and come up with a new system of measurement. I don't know. It gets messy. The answer is publishing books, like writing is a beautiful thing and publishing is a very messy thing, fraught with many feelings. I'd say my mom, when I told my mom that I had hit the New York Times list for Gallant, she said, "Are you overjoyed or just relieved?" Huh. And I was like, oh man, thanks for calling me out there. But there's definitely this measure of like relief when you're far enough into your career and you just like want things to not be flukes. You want things to continue to land and to grow.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be as successful as you've been. And I know it's just got to be surreal sometimes too.
It is, but you know, so I've been in publishing for 12 years. And like, I think in a lot of ways, I'm very grateful that I didn't start out large. Like I didn't achieve success very early. So even though I started really young, and so I'm not terribly old to have had 21 books published, like I started at like 20. And so I think when you have success right off the bat, it almost makes everything harder because you don't really have anywhere to go but down, or any in your head anywhere to go but down. But I started out really small. And so like, I didn't really achieve, and I'll say success as like earning out or satisfying a publisher, making a publisher feel like you're a good investment. Mm-hmm. Probably like 7 or 8 books in, I was just like hanging on by the skin of my teeth for the first 5 or 6. And so I'm just like, I think that's where relief comes in. Is like, I'm just really glad that I have hit some kind of mass with my books and my readership now, that I don't feel every day like it might fall apart. I always describe it as like when a book comes out and is really popular, if it's like a debut novel, the readership is a teacup. Like it's deeper than it is wide. Like it's just a small portion of water. But I started with a puddle. It's very thin. And there was like a little, and so what's happened is over the last 10 years, it's become a lake. And like it took time to get the depth. But I'm really grateful that it took that time, because now it's a more stable thing. I'm not a teacup that can just be like tipped over on a bad day.
Right. That's a really great way to describe it. I've never heard anybody describe it like that before.
You'll discover I'm an obsessive user of metaphors.
That is okay. I love that. I love that. Well, how was writing Gallant different than writing some of your other books?
Well, I wrote it during the pandemic. So that tells you how long we've been in the pandemic, that I wrote, edited, and had a novel published, and we are still in the pandemic. It had the inauspiciousness of coming on the heels of Addie LaRue. So it was the first book that I wrote after Addie, which, like I say, took 10 years to do, but at the same time was also my most like successful book in terms of sales measurements. And so I ended up with like a million new readers dropped into that lake in like a less than a year period. And what that's amazing. And I'm so grateful. But at the same time, then trying to write another book after that was like, oh no.
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing? Especially because Addie, for anyone who's read any of my other books, like Addie's the outlier. Addie is not like the rest of my books. Addie is like a completely different genre and a different audience and a different style. And it's a standalone. And so you go through this moment where you're like, oh no, I should just be writing that. That's what sells. But it's like the algorithms online, right? On social media, it like tricks you. You're like, oh, that was a big success. There's no guarantee that if I wrote another book like Addie, it would land that way. It would go viral in that way. And so I had a lot of my own psychology to get through to write the book after Addie. And to do that while in lockdown as well, I think really informed kind of the atmosphere, the claustrophobia of Gallant.
Having to write a book through a pandemic, you know, I keep hearing lots of authors say just how different it was being trapped at home and inside, and a whole different experience for all of those reasons, but definitely adding on, you know, after Addie, that was so different. You know, I'm thinking about what you're saying, are just standalones more successful than series? I mean, who knows, right? Who knows? Like maybe that particular book. I love reading series, but there are definitely times where I'm like, no, I just need a one and done, you know,
And I mean, as a writer as well, right? Like we approach a standalone differently than a series. It has a totality to it. It has a wholeness. And I think it can be really satisfying to have closure on your own narrative in that way. And like I say, I've written other standalones that have not succeeded like Addie has. So I don't think it's a difference of standalone versus series. I think it's just timing and luck and who knows what else goes into the pot.
Well, can you tell everyone what Gallant is all about?
Of course. So the shortest version of the pitch is that Gallant is the Secret Garden meets Crimson Peak. The slightly more expanded version is that Gallant is the story of Olivia Pryor, a teenage girl who has spent the majority of her life in an orphanage with nothing of her family's except a journal with entries from her mother that seem to devolve into madness and illustrations that make no sense. But at the back of the journal is a letter to Olivia from her mother. And at the end of the letter, Olivia's mother tells her that she will be safe so long as she stays away from Gallant. And for years, Olivia has no idea what this means, until one day she receives a note from an uncle that she's never met, inviting her to come home to the family estate, which is called Gallant. And Olivia gets there only to find no uncle, a house falling into disrepair, a garden being strangled by strange weeds, and a wall at the back of the property with a locked door that seems to lead nowhere.
Those locked doors. I know, telling you, but I love how you described it. I definitely got Secret Garden vibes. You know, ever since I was little, I've always saw the Secret Garden and then read the book. I've definitely always been that. I was always that child, and I'm still that adult who, if I'm out somewhere, like, I'm always exploring and looking for like a hidden door or something. I love going to like old ruins and walking around. I'm like, what am I going to find here?
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's just something so fun and mysterious about it. And they just pulls you in. So I definitely would have made some of the exact same choices that Olivia did when she was at the wall for sure.
I think it's the potential, right? It's that like, whenever you encounter a door, especially where a door shouldn't be, you're kind of intoxicated by the potential of what could be on the other side.
Yes. Where did the idea for Gallant come about?
You know, it's really interesting. We get asked about ideas a lot as authors, but we always talk about ideas as if they're single entities. When the truth is that, like, for the vast majority of stories, ideas are more like ingredients in a meal. So it's less about getting the whole single idea for a story and more about coming across a number of ingredients that excite you and that come together. So for me, I can never really talk about ideas as anything more than like these fragment bites. And so like, I knew I wanted to write about an estate. I knew I wanted to write about a nonverbal protagonist, because Olivia Pryor is nonverbal. And I wanted to look at like the ways that a voice takes shape and the different forms that it takes. I wanted to write a kind of portal story about a garden wall, especially like, you know, we talk about going to ruins, and I think about the wall at the back of the Gallant house is essentially a ruin. And a wall really only works if it's containing something, if it's keeping something in or out. So a ruin wall doesn't do anything because you can walk all the way around it. So then it begs the question of, why is there a locked door? You know, what is the necessity of a locked door in a wall that keeps nothing in or out? And so I think I was really just intrigued by that question. And I set out to answer it.
And that was something that intrigued me as I started reading it right away when she first gets to Gallant, because that's what I thought was, why is the door locked? She can just walk around the other side of the wall.
Exactly.
Anybody can. What does that mean? So
yeah,
it was fun to really explore that, you know, the further you get into the book, as I'm sure it was for you with writing it.
Yeah. Well, for a long time, I didn't write the book because I thought it was a fairy tale and I kept like staring at this door, trying to figure out what was beyond it. And, you know, you're writing a fairy tale. And so it becomes this line between the domestic and the wild. And you think about fairy tales as happening in forests and having fey elements to them, sometimes nefarious ones, but fey ones. And I just kept looking at this door, this fictional door, and thinking like, I don't want to write a fairy tale. That's not what I'm doing here. What am I doing? And then one day I realized, oh, I'm not writing a fairy tale. I'm writing an underworld tale. And as soon as I figured that out, that I wasn't going really out, but down, that like was how I was ready to write the book.
I love that. And I love how dark and creepy and the like gothic underworld, definitely atmosphere that it has. And I do feel like part of what really adds that is that there isn't a whole lot of dialogue in the book, because like you said, Olivia is nonverbal. So what was that like, kind of developing a story that had such little dialogue in it, and especially a main character who's nonverbal?
I mean, it was a challenge, but I think that's important because I think as authors, we have so many defaults, things that we default to in our storytelling. Dialogue is one of the biggest ones. And so to take that off the table for Olivia, it set a new set of creative challenges. But I also, she never wasn't nonverbal. It's not like a version of Olivia ever existed that was verbal. So, you know, I wanted to explore the isolation and the loneliness that comes from not having a method of communication that goes both ways, you know? And I also you know, but it informed everything. Like, for instance, it informed the decision to write the book in third person because I knew that it would have an audiobook. And if it had an audiobook that was a first person narration, then whoever was narrating the audiobook would become Olivia's voice. And I didn't want that. So like from page one, I knew that these were challenges that needed to be faced, but I was excited to face them.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that at all with the audiobook, but that makes so much sense. Yeah, to think about it in that aspect. All of the things you have to think about when you're writing.
All of them. And obviously, I don't think that Olivia's voice has any difficulty coming across. I think it's very clear. And so then the question becomes, well, like, how else do we convey a character and their internal landscape and their, you know, we emote physically, we emote with our face, we emote through the way we engage with the world around us. And so it really was a good exercise and a good reminder to me that like spoken language is really only one way in which we move through the world.
Definitely. And Olivia definitely does a great job of communicating, even though she can't speak. What you just said, how was saying, you know, spoken language is not the only way we communicate. That's something I tell my students all the time because I'm a theater teacher. And so I'm constantly like focusing on, you have to use 100%. Your face and your bodies and, you know.
Exactly.
And Olivia totally does that. I loved reading about all, you know, all the different ways and seeing that she was able to communicate, like even, you know, in a way at the piano too, with communicating with that. I don't want to say too much about that.
I think it's like Olivia is in no way a silent character. And I think we conflate unspoken with silent. And so that was something I wanted to challenge.
There's a lot of loss that's explored in the book in a different way with family members and relationships. Tell me what it was like kind of exploring those themes as you were writing the story.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Out of the woods can the moon...
Moon Carter is a family fictional podcast, and I mean for the family. Parents, do you find it really hard to make it through your children's podcasts?
Then listen to Moon Carter and join me, Splot, and the gang on our magical adventures. Click all the links below or get it from where you get your podcast from. But if you need to be told that, then I worry about you. Splot. It's like drink water from where water's from. What's that about?
Not helping. Moon Carter is a podcast. You like it.
It's interesting because I was just on a panel at a book festival. The panel was on grief. And I was like, what am I doing here? Because I write about death, but that's not the same as grief. And I think when you say loss, and I think absence, I think about like the absences in people's life and how we fill them. So found family is a really big theme in my work, and friendship and space and what makes a house a home, and basically like how do we fill our houses, both our metaphorical ones and our physical ones. So I think absence or loss is the thing that paves the way for relationships of choice, because often what's absent is a relationship that was not one of choice, right? Family, in the case of Olivia, her parents, and a house, a home. And so for her, she has the opportunity to choose to make a decision about her life, about who is in it now and where she's going to be. Home is a choice is a line from the book that is a lot more encompassing than the physical parameters of the house.
Yes, the way that you say absence is definitely a better way of saying it than loss, because when we find her, she didn't really remember her parents very much either. So
she doesn't crave a mother. Like, this is a thing that is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine when I'm reading books that do have orphans in them. Classic trope, right? Is the orphan is a child is orphaned in children's fiction because we need the absence of the parents in order for the child to have their adventure. But I think the thing that always I see that I always feel a little bit could be disingenuous is when the absence of the parents means that the child longs for the parents. But it's like, if you don't have something, or there's just, I think like we have to pay attention to the context. Sometimes what we're not trying to replace what we don't understand, what we don't have that relationship. So we don't have the context for it. Olivia has, for all intents and purposes, never had a mother or father. That's not what she thinks that she's seeking for. What she's seeking for is security. and a place of her own, because that's the other thing she's never had. And unlike family that she doesn't really have any context for, she is very much in an environment where she doesn't have her own space and her own place and her own autonomy. And so these are the things that she's longing for. Her mother is a mystery that she wants to solve, not a person that she wants to replace.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes it felt like too, she was, you know, even though with being in the orphanage, she was surrounded by people, she was still lonely too. So it's more of the loneliness I felt like too. And then with her being able to go to Gallant, even though her mother's letter said, don't do it. You know, she's like, but this could be a new beginning, a new place to find a home and to maybe not be lonely.
And answers. I mean, right. I think like Olivia wants to solve a puzzle that has been plaguing her whole life.
And the journal is not, you know, it's confusing to her some spots. So that's another kind of thing for her to solve and look into and see if she can figure out. And then when she gets there, the people at Gallant
get a lot messier.
Yes. Which makes it fun and fantastic. Yeah. How did Gallant evolve and change as you wrote it? Like, were there parts that you loved that you maybe ended up taking out?
No. So I'm a pretty methodical writer. Okay. I'm an outliner. I like to have a roadmap. For me, a lot of the discovery process, the art of it happens before I actually start drafting the book. So for me, the fun, the discovery, the brainstorm is the outline. And then when I sit down to write the story, that's an execution. So for me, the satisfaction and the relief is in successfully executing something that I had designed. So there wasn't surprises or changes in that way, except for the fact that, like I say, I went 4 years without actually putting pen to paper on this book because I couldn't figure out the boundary between fairy tale and underworld tale that I wanted to write. For me, what I need before I sit down to write is the ending, the literal ending, like the last page. I need to know exactly where we end so I can figure out where I want to begin. And I also feel like the ending is then the thing that I am thematically moving toward. So in order to land that ending, I want to then figure out which seeds I need to plant, which motifs I want to weave along the way to make that ending as potent as possible. Mm-hmm. But Gallant is the very first novel that I have ever written in order.
Oh, wow.
I do not write in order at all because I outline in order. Because I have like a map, then the execution becomes this piecemeal puzzle that I'm fitting together. I write my scenes, the sentences in my scenes out of order. Like I'm extraordinarily weird. It only works for me. It's a language only I speak and I'm okay with that. But there was something about the intimacy of this story, of it being in many ways a small story because it's one point of view, one direction. And I normally have like multiple points of view and I'm moving between past and present and future. And so because of the intimacy of this story, I decided to essentially treat it like a snowball being rolled down a hill, gathering mass. And I started on page one and didn't let myself jump around, which is what I normally do. And I wrote the entire draft in order. And that sounds so mundane, except that 20 books before it, I have not done that.
I think I love that. I think that's fascinating because, you know, every author has a different method, a different way that they write. Yeah. You know, everybody's brains kind of function differently. And I think for me, like if it were me, I think I would also need to start like to know where it would end. Like I would, because I would not be able to, I'm always amazed when there are authors who tell me I had no idea how it was going to end.
Oh my God, it drives me crazy because I'm like,
How do you do that?
How do you know? They're like, I'm just exploring. And I'm like, why wouldn't you explore it in the planning stages? But it's like, I think it really is. I've thought about this a lot. I think depends on the anxiety level of the writer. Because my friends like who write that way, the whole joy of the creative process for them is the mystery to themselves. And for me, I am wound far too tightly. That would cause me so much panic. Like I need to know that there's enough story. I need to know that there's enough depth. I need to know that there are enough twists. I need to know these elements or else I will quit. I am constantly like at war trying to talk myself out of like doing the job. because it's just like, I'm in my own way. I'm a self-doubt machine. Mm-hmm. So a lot of why I do what I do is I do enjoy the mystery as I'm brainstorming, but like, yeah, it would just be paralyzing to me in the actual drafting process to not know where I'm going.
I that makes so much sense to me because I like my brain. I mean, I'm a creative person as well, but like, I also have these logical spots and writing when I write, cause I, I'm a blogger and so I'll write and edit, but I have to know where it's going to end too, because
100%
otherwise it would be too hard for me. Like I have to have
it's also a tolerance for lost words, right? Like mm-hmm. I don't have a big tolerance for lost words. My friends will be like, well, sure, I had to throw out those three chapters. And I'm like,
right.
Don't do that. So I feel like you have to have a tolerance for moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah. That makes so much sense. Something else that I love about Olivia is that she kind of has this little secret of her own where she can see these ghosts and other people can't see them. And I think it was especially fun reading that when she was in the orphanage, because she can see all these ghosts around all the other girls who are in the orphanage. And it's almost like, if only you knew there was a ghost right there, you know, and since she doesn't really get along with them, I feel like it's something I would use to my advantage and be like, hey, I'm going to communicate with you, ghost. You go do this to her.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? Well, for a long time, Olivia doesn't realize that she can't, then that they do understand her, mm-hmm. right? Ghosts, the ghouls in the story, they are like ghosts. They're haunting her. She's haunted for a long, she wonders at first if the ghouls are confined to the orphanage. It turns out that they are confined to her. Yeah. So they go where she sees people wherever she goes. And they are that like very particular kind of haunting where they need to be noticed, but they don't like being seen. And so they're the kind of thing you glimpse out of the corner of your eye. Mm-hmm. Like you never see them whole. You never see them fully realized, and they don't like to be looked at directly. So she glimpses them, but they kind of are almost like a confidant. And she can have that knowing glance. She can have that shared moment with them, mm-hmm. the way that like a character on a TV show would break the fourth wall and look at the audience. That's her version, is that she kind of like meets eyes with the ghouls. It's a shared secret, as you said.
Yeah. And I loved that she couldn't see all of them and there were only pieces, because it just really adds more to the mystery of the story and to her life. Because I mean, it got me wondering like, why can she see these things and nobody else can see them? You know, it just makes it.
And there is a reason.
Yes, there is. Which everybody listening, you're all just going to have to go read this book.
I was going to say it is a spoiler, so I won't say it, but there is a reason for Olivia's gifts in the book.
Yes. But it's fun reading them that way, because I think I'm so used to a story that has ghouls or ghosts in it where you see the whole thing. Maybe sometimes they do even communicate with the person who can see them, and just having it the way that you crafted it just makes it so much more mysterious and really like pulls you in as a reader a lot more. So.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Now, is there anything about Gallant that maybe you haven't shared yet in any of your interviews, something nobody's asked you, or anything that's like, man, I've been wanting to talk about this and nobody has brought this up yet?
God, that's always like the worst question for me, because I'm always like, no, I'm like an open book to the worst point. Like I'm always saying things I shouldn't say. I'm always like talking about, but I talk about books that aren't even out yet. Like I'm bad. So no, I don't know. I think I am really, really in love with the master of the house, who's like a figure that you meet in the book. I can't really say anything else about him.
Nope.
Except that like, I love him. And what I love is that like, in the creating of him, I saw the place where I could turn left instead of right if I wanted to make this like a more commercial novel. I could have constructed him as like a sexy teenage boy, right? He could have appeared to Olivia in any form. And that would have been like the smart thing to do probably, is to like give her this like, you know, but the thing is like Olivia is not interested in sex. she's interested in family. And I think that's mm-hmm. a bridge that she wants to cross first. So it like felt disingenuous, and it, the master of the house in a lot of ways came to symbolize for me the creative freedom that my publisher was giving me, because this is being called my first all ages read. It has elements that are vaguely middle grade. It has elements that are YA, and it has elements that are adult. And I can see like how a past version of me would have felt the imperative, if not been told outright by my publisher, to like quantify, mm-hmm. to put it in one of the categories for sales. And maybe it's the success of Abby LaRue or the last 10 years finally like building to a point that my publisher was like, we trust your readers. Like, they come for you regardless of where we shelve it. So do what you want to do with the story. And so the master of the house became kind of symbolic of that freedom.
I could see that, you know, having read the story, and I loved him too. Like, yeah.
He's so creepy too. He's like an old version of Howl from Howl's Moving Castle. Like, I want him to be weird and creepy, but not sexy.
Right. No, no. Yeah. And he definitely is weird and creepy, and he's fantastic and perfect. Yeah. I kind of had, when I was reading it too, I got some, you know, vibes of like M. Night Shyamalan when he makes his movies, especially with the movie Signs. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but he just has certain elements of it where it's like silent and then these other and mysterious, and that makes it even more creepy, like how in Signs you never actually see the aliens until the very end. And we don't see the master of the house for a while.
For a long time. Yeah.
So that added to that as well. And yeah.
He's again, just talk about like sometimes the thing that's most potent is the absence, because mm-hmm. also look at all horror or anything that deals with fear and the unknown, and like the reader or viewer's imagination will craft for them something uniquely tailored. So when we as writers dictate it, what we risk doing is losing the reader who would have tailored it to themselves. And so I like now and then to create enough space so that my readers can create some of the visuals for themselves, can insert some of their own ideas into the story. I think it makes it a closer knit.
Yes. And speaking of visuals, the cover for this book is fantastic. Oh my gosh.
I'm so happy with it. I'm so happy with it. The cover and the illustrations both. I just feel very, very lucky.
Yes, they are. They are so good. Now I was reading it, the NetGalley on my phone. So
yes,
I could see the illustrations, but not like as big, but I'm excited to get my hard copy in the mail and then be able to see them in bigger form.
The illustrations are extraordinary. I can say that because I did not do them. like they are a work of art.
Yes. Well, I'm excited. Or do you think that you might write any more books in this kind of like gothic horror type genre? Or was this maybe like this was in here and had to get out, but now it's out. So I'm not so sure.
I don't know, you know, never say never, but I don't like to do the same thing twice. And a lot of that, you know, of course you can tell different stories in the same gothic setting, but I don't like to tell the same story twice. And for me, setting is a main character. So it's hard for me to tell different stories against the same backdrop without it feeling too close, just because of how important setting is. But that's not to say that I wouldn't tell another story that could sit next to this one very easily. It just wouldn't be like, this is a standalone. So I could write like I could see myself writing a companion in a, you know, different place, but like almost like, so I just finished watching The Haunting of Hill House, which is very scary, but like, the same creator did Haunting of Hill House, Haunting of Bly Manor, and Midnight Mass, three very different Netflix shows. They're all beautiful. They all very easily sit beside one another. Like they are of a set, even though they're completely different stories. Mm-hmm. I can see myself doing something like that, where I would have a series of gothic standalone atmospheric reads, but I don't know. I like to use this metaphor of a six burner stove for the inside of my head, that I always have one project on high heat and the rest on low heat. I don't have anything on low heat yet to take that spot, but that's not to say that I won't in a few years.
Never know. Never so what know. Do you have something else that you're working on now?
Always. Always. Well, my first YA television show comes out this summer, which is
so
very, very exciting.
Exciting.
It's called First Kill, and it's coming out on Netflix this summer. And it is about, it's based on a short story that I wrote actually called First Kill. And it's about a teenage vampire named Juliet who has to commit her first kill in order to like access her full vampire self. And she has a crush on a girl at her school named Calliope. And she decides that Calliope is going to be her first kill because you're supposed to pick someone that you like, of course. And they end up at a house party together and Juliet goes to bite Calliope and Calliope goes to stake her in the heart because it turns out that Calliope is a budding vampire hunter who needs to make her own first kill.
Of course. I mean, that makes sense, right?
So it's just like a super gay Buffy.
I'm
really excited. It's kind of show. It's going to be campy and fun. And it's the kind of show that I just really wish I had when I was a teenager. And then I'm working on my next novel, which is, I write a series called the Shades of Magic series, which has three books in it. And this is the Threads of Power series, which is the sequel series to it. So like books 1 through 3 are Shades of Magic, books 4 through 6 are Threads of Power. So this is book four.
All right. Well, that's very exciting. I am definitely going to check out First Kill when it comes out.
Yes, please watch it.
Oh my gosh, that sounds fantastic and right up my alley. I'm very amazing. Excited about this now. Amazing.
Also, I'm really excited too. It's been a lot of fun.
Also, I love that Juliet and Calliope, those names are just like perfect and beautiful.
Well, and the vampire, the hunter family, all of their names are great. They're all drawn from like Greek mythology. So her older brothers are Theseus and Apollo.
Oh, I love that. I'm a huge Greek mythology person. So like,
oh my God, I'm excited. It's on the hunter side. It's the three of the three children are Theseus, Apollo, and Calliope. Theseus goes by Theo. And then on the vampire side, the three children are Eleanor, Oliver, and Juliet.
Oh my goodness. It's perfect. I love it. Oh, I'm so excited now to check that out.
Yeah, it should be fun.
All right. I'm gonna write that down. So I've got it saved for Netflix when it comes out. Well, amazing. I can't thank you enough for being here today. This has been so much fun. And I'm glad that you had a chance to come on and chat with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And thank you so much to everybody for listening. Please, please be sure to go out and purchase Gallant and read it because you will not regret it. And I will put links in the show notes today for you to purchase that, as well as to Victoria's website and her Instagram so that you can follow her and check out her website and all of her books and everything that's coming. So thanks everybody for listening and we will chat again soon. Today's episode featured the book Gallant by V.E. Schwab. A special thank you to V.E. Schwab for coming on YA Book Chat today and spending some time with me. And thank you to Lauren Levite at HarperCollins for setting this interview up. Be sure to follow YA Book Chat on Instagram and Facebook. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast so you get your episodes as soon as they are available. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, if you could take just a minute and leave a 5-star rating and a positive review, that would really help a lot. And I really do appreciate it. Have you checked out the YA Book Chat Patreon yet? You should. There are lots of perks for listeners, such as bonus episodes, behind the scenes info, and lots more. YA Book Chat was created by, is hosted, and edited by me, Leah Stuhler.